Jaguars release ambitious new plans for downtown. Six local schools are getting new names and saying goodbye to memories of the Confederacy. And the governor signs a controversial new piece of legislation into law here in Jacksonville. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. We're live on the radio and streaming video live on YouTube and Facebook, so join us there too. As we talk about all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, get on the line and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, Women's Wednesdays returns to St. Augustine this month. We'll tell you about it. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a jam-packed week of news, we're pleased to welcome Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hey, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record is here. Hi, Mike.
Morning, Melissa. Good to be with you.
Good to have you on the show, and regular contributor Fred Matthews. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Hear you and see you again.
Yes, and everyone can see you guys right now live on our Facebook page, both the WJCT page and the First Coast Connect page, or check us out on YouTube. Lots to talk about this week, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And as I said, you can comment on Facebook as you watch the video stream. Well, our top story, the Jacksonville Jaguars this week announced new development plans for downtown and the shipyards. They include a Four Seasons hotel and residences, an office building, even a sports medicine complex, and improvements to the city-owned marina. They say they're even going to take environmental considerations into their planning for this project. The Jaguars, of course, failed in their attempt to get city financing earlier this year for another development that was known to all of us as Lot J, a development they wanted to build on that parking lot next to the stadium. They're taking another bite at the apple, and Jaguars president Mark Lamping and Jaguars owner Shad Khan say this could transform downtown. As we talk about this, we want your calls. Give us a call, 549-2937, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. There's so much to this announcement, but let's begin with the anchor they want to build, a Four Seasons hotel on the banks of the St. John's River. Is this something that can be successful? That, I think, is a question a lot of us have. This is a high-end hotel, really expensive to stay there. Will it fill up? Will it attract people? And can it spur other development around it, another foot traffic and excitement and growth? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think this is one of those questions where you really sift the optimists from the cynics among us.
And, yes.
You know, there is a great thing about dreaming big, of course, and Shad Khan has proven his own life story is sort of built on that, right? That you can dream big, you can achieve your dreams. And I'm a kind of person who's never stayed in a five-star hotel. So there's a gulf between people like me and him, and certainly between a five-star hotel and the city that lives a mile away. So it is a vast ambition. I haven't seen any clientele in this city that would fill a Four Seasons on a regular basis. But if they go ahead with this plan to build, you know, this sort of mecca for, you know, rehabilitation, travel, tourism for health and orthopedic reasons, you know, they could be appealing to a big, first of all, football base out there. You know, there's a lot of athletes with injuries who have a lot of money. They could be tapping into an audience, you know, of people that I just don't interact with typically in Jacksonville, and bringing in a whole new clientele. So I think there's a reason for people who run in those circles to have that sort of optimism. It is certainly very different from the Jacksonville we've known, and a very different ambition than a lot of the more rudimentary needs of the city.
549-2937. Yes, so let's talk about rudimentary needs. The total estimated cost for phase one of this project is over $440 million. Mike Mendenhall, you covered this announcement. Of course, the Jaguars are going to seek some city skin in the game for this thing. They're going to want some incentives. The taxpayer revolt over Lot J showed there isn't a lot of appetite among the public out there for these kinds of incentives, but they're just a reality in today's world whenever these big type of urban projects are envisioned. So take us through that.
Yeah, so I mean, as far as, you know, the public's appetite for incentives, I mean, you're absolutely right. Every time, you know, a deal like this comes out, there's skepticism amongst taxpayers. You know, I think that if you ask developers in the market, they'll say, you know, well, you know, Jacksonville is it's an up and coming downtown. The density is not quite there yet to have these types of projects be financially sustainable on their own. And they'll argue that, you know, at some point in the future, you can phase out the incentives, but for now we need them. But if you compare what the Jaguars are asking now to what they were asking for in Lot J, the term sheet that that the DIA is looking at with them actually has about $93 million in incentives for the shipyards portion of phase one. But the majority of that money, what's different from Lot J is that it's going to be paid out mostly in the back end. So like on the after things are constructed. So it's a REV grant, which is a tax refund generally of like $44 million and a completion grant of $28 million. And the rest is infrastructure from the city on the marina, environmental remediation, and those kind of things. So it's not the controversial breadbox loan, if you'll recall, mm-hmm. from the Lot J deal, that is not a part of this. So that's but then it also doesn't include the $60 million that they're requesting from the city on the performance center.
Yeah. Fred Matthews, obviously the Jaguars took their lumps over that failed Lot J deal, and they're coming back now with a fresh look that seems to take into account some of those nuances Mike mentioned. This is a big, bold. You're already laughing. This is a big, bold plan. Can it succeed?
Well, at first blush, it does appear to be more palatable than the Lot J deal by itself. They're not going to tinker with the Metropolitan Park area, which saves, by the way, Channel 7 also from being dealt with. Mm-hmm. It does appear that their bold plan will move the Veterans Memorial Wall to someplace else that had been discussed before. And the five-star hotel with all of its accoutrements around it is something that if he wants to build it, fine, it won't do any harm. The risk is on Mr. Khan in attracting folks to come there outside of the 6 to 7 months of the football season that we see. But everything around it will enhance that section of town. We can't necessarily say it will do anything more for downtown, because this is something that if we're trying to attract large conventions to downtown, it will enhance that. But it does appear to be more palatable financially. And by the way, the folks on the east side down A. Philip Randolph Boulevard recently have been offered what you can call a sort of a business grant from Mr. Khan's organization to help them along. This will all that grant to those businesses along A. Philip Randolph Boulevard will also ease and quell a great deal of discussion or opposition against what would be happening over here. Because the other thing is, there's going to be a great deal of parking that has to be made up for around this grand plan, and that parking has to be put somewhere. The question is where. But much more palatable plan, I think.
Yeah. And getting back to what you said, Anne, this is the ultimate, if you build it, they will come swing for the fences, because you, of course, work across the street from us at First Coast News. I'm sitting here at WJCT in the midst of all of this. If folks were to drive down here right now, what they would see is... there's no other way to say it. It looks like a dystopian hellscape right now outside our doors. Okay. It looks so bad.
Perhaps the Four Seasons can use that as their selling line.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a dystopian hellscape. Join us.
Exactly. I mean, they took down the Hart Bridge ramp and the elevated road that comes off the Hart Bridge. They are reconstructing all of that. And when you drive through here now, through the sports complex area, you just see a bunch of rubble, really just rubble everywhere, Caterpillar trucks, construction cones. There's nothing around here other than the football games and the concerts at Daly's Place, which are, you know, here and there, that would compel you to come down. And so Khan is betting that they can transform this whole part of the city and bring in the kind of tourism and the kind of foot traffic that we've never seen in the urban core. And, you know, it's going to be interesting, if nothing else, Anne, to watch this play out in this little corner of the world we work in.
Right. Well, you know, part of that vision is, you know, realizing that we have an incredible, you know, beautiful natural asset that's mm-hmm. largely been hidden from sight,
right,
and from access in a large direction in that area. So they are opening it up. And, you know, when you talk about skin in the game, clearly we've been laying the groundwork for this expansion, this Shad Khan vision, with a fair amount of skin in the game, just with this bridge removal, you know, all of the effort and, you know, state money and everything that's gone into taking down a fully functioning elevated roadway. But that's part of the, you know, that's part of the deal. And so that hellscape will be cleaned up and immaculate, I'm sure, if it's transformed as they want it to be into this luxury brand hotel. But what's interesting is, you know, it's all of this is kind of dependent on, you know, these other elements like this practice facility, which is now, you know, on top of the Daly's Field, which was going to be the practice facility to free up the stadium. And now they're going to free up Daly's Place for, you know, other people to use while they have three new fields in this new building that they want the city to help finance. And in order for, you know, stadium renovations to begin, that project of this new facility has to get the green light and the funding. So, you know, and then the stadium renovations are going to be contingent on the lease extension. And so all of this from the beginning of tearing down the Hart Bridge is stacked on all of these other variables, ultimately leading to, you know, how is the city going to negotiate with the Jaguars to get them to extend their lease and stay in Jacksonville?
Okay, let's go to your calls now. 549-2937. Eugene on the north side. Hi, Eugene. Go ahead. Go ahead, Eugene.
I got a brief comment. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a brief comment. First of all, I think the direction, the intention is good, but we're putting too many eggs in one basket. We're giving Mr. Khan and his organization the keys to the city, and that's not the direction that we need to be going in, you know, and down the line, it's going to put the city in a real dilemma. So what we need to do is back away from this and tell Mr. Khan to stay in his lane and do football and let the folks that are involved in moving the city forward do their business. But he's way out his lane. Have a nice day.
All right.
Comments off the air.
Thanks, Eugene. You know, Mike Mendenhall, several years ago, I was at a luncheon at the stadium where Shad Khan spoke to a business group, and he said, a homeless guy in Detroit has more mojo than the leadership class in Jacksonville. And I'm going to change that, basically, was the tone of his comments. He clearly sees himself as more than a team owner. And, you know, he's a businessman first and foremost. He's doing what he likes to do, what he has the wherewithal to do. But what about the comment that he should just focus on football?
I mean, I think that when you look at professional sports in general, when you look, it's all about, it's not just about the sports anymore, it's about the experience. And I think that's the argument that Shad Khan and the Jaguars are making. You know, they look at a lot of other professional sports teams around the country, and you see entertainment and restaurants and development going up around the stadium, a lot to support, you know, or themed on sports, but to support that and to create an environment. And Right now, I mean, clearly, if you go down near TIA Bank Field, you know, the stadium kind of feels like an island unto itself. It's, you know, you have to go several blocks before you get to the first, you know, the first pub or the first entertainment experience. And so I think that, you know, Shad Khan, I think, is trying to make the case that to make, you know, NFL football viable in Jacksonville, that experience needs to build up around it. Now, but the argument, it still goes back to, you know, what should the taxpayers of Duval County be responsible for? How much of that should be investment from the city and from the taxpayers, and how much of that is Shad Khan's personal vision, and so him and his, you know, his development financing company should take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fred, we're already getting emails and comments about that, saying why does the city have to kick in so much money for a billionaire? You hear that over and over again, of course, but as we've talked about a lot on this program, this is the reality, not just in Jacksonville, but in most cities that try to get something going in their urban cores. There's almost always taxpayer dollars in the mix.
Well, that is the way it is. The city has kicked in money on almost every project that has been developed in downtown. The new groundbreaking this past week on the South Bank of that long-awaited project that initially included Mr. Khan's rival, Mr. Rummel, had city funds involved in getting that done. And the DIA was very much involved in helping the new developer get that accomplished. The city will own the land for the most part in this new development that they're discussing now, but that is not unusual. The city has a process in which the DIA doles out X amount of funds for any new major development that comes to town. We just announced the new financial services deal, wherein the city is going to give the city and the state are going to give X amount of dollars for the amount of jobs that they guarantee to bring to Jacksonville. So this is not new business. It is just a grander plan visually than we've had in recent years. And look, Mr. Khan is taking a great risk on his end, reputation-wise and everything else, to get this done. So this is not new business. It's not unusual. It is a lot less than that we've gone before. And let's face it, once the mayor tore down the ramps, the Hart Bridge ramps, this pretty much kept all of this in motion. It is going to happen. It's just a question of how soon.
5492937, as we talk about the Jaguars' plans to build a Four Seasons downtown on the riverfront, along with a lot of other stuff. Omar is downtown. Hi, Omar. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Go ahead.
Just a few things that I've picked up on in this conversation, which I always think are really funny. One, like, so I'm from here. I'm a black person. I grew up pretty well within that, you know, environment. So I may not have had the money to understand renting a room at the Four Seasons, but I definitely have some friends that do. So it comes across as like this kind of insecure feeling about that we have about our city, that, oh, no, we can't do anything that's outside of like middle class or anything that's outside of just the regular. And even being connected to a football team is, to me, a little bit, you know, not exactly highbrow. But, you know, hell, at least it's something. It isn't. We have the Ritz-Carlton right down the road. It's been open for decades. They don't have a problem. It's the same caliber of hotel. So the argument that, oh, you know, the city can't support a hotel like that, I mean, Jacksonville has never been a poor town. Like, let's be honest. So I think we need to change the way we think about how we address maybe elevating some of what we have already. Like, you know, sure, I prefer an aquarium. But, yeah, I'll take this. This looks like a better plan, and the architecture looks good, and he's donating half his money. Like, that's Shad Khan. That's his money. Like, you know, at least for us, our tax dollars will eventually be replenished, like, pretty quickly, probably. So I think the risk is maybe more on him than it is on us. So, you know, I think we always look at these things from a very one-sided view, and also I live downtown, you know, so like, hey, it would be great to do that, like, outside of a Jaguar game, because that's really when anyone ever comes downtown. So, you know, I'm kind of for it, surprisingly.
Yeah, the idea of, I hear you, Omar, the idea of really truly being aspirational. with this plan, really transforming the way, not only the way the urban core downtown looks, but the way the city thinks about itself. Mike in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to this, and I rarely call in, but I feel like we're missing the bigger picture. The core and the downtown is no longer Jacksonville's downtown. Downtown is town center. And for us to be spending money in and around the stadium is just a waste of time and money. Nobody's coming down there other than to go to a football game.
Well, the whole idea is to make it so attractive that people would come down. That's what this is all about.
It's a failed effort, and it's not going to work. It has never worked. It's not going to work this time.
Well, I guess we'll find out, won't we, Mike? I understand your skepticism. You're certainly not alone. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Well, let's move on and talk about another big headline from the week. Earlier this week, the Duval County School Board voted to change the names of six schools named for Confederate generals. There were dueling protests outside the administration building as the board voted. The most prominent name change, of course, is Lee High, which will become Riverside High. A number of other schools also lose their names, although two schools named after Jean Ribaut, the Huguenot French explorer, will keep their names along with Jackson High School. When the kids go back to school later this year in August, the names will be official. At the same time, a renaming fund surpassed $80,000 by Wednesday as people donated for the effort to change signage, school uniforms, and more. Let us know your thoughts about this at 549-2937. Ann Schindler, you know, this is something that the majority of the public clearly wanted. There's been some criticism that the school board should have just done this and not taken nearly a year to make it official.
Well, yeah, I mean, a year plus the last 26 years.
Yeah.
You know, I've been in this market reporting since the early 90s, and in the late 90s, we had a similar drawn out debate over the name of a school named after the founder of the KKK. And it took many tries that failed, even though he was a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. So, mm-hmm. You know, the Confederate generals were the next step. This city has proven a difficult place to budge on some of these issues, but I think that there's just enough momentum right now to make these kind of changes. And clearly people are, you know, taking advantage of the opportunity to use the momentum and the conversations that are happening nationally and internationally around race. It's interesting, though, I was talking to some coworkers about, you know, the name change and teaching kids about why these names would be changed, you know, mm-hmm. why they're offensive. And given this new vote that's coming next week that would limit what teachers can teach about American history, these new BEST guidelines that are being pushed by the Republican legislature and supported by the governor might actually prevent teachers from teaching students about why those names might be offensive, mm-hmm. because the goal is to teach American history in a very traditional and perhaps sunnier sense and less critical of some of the things that this country has done, including a local government that chose names that were specifically antagonistic and hurtful to most Black Americans.
Right. Here's a tweet from a listener. Why did school board member Lori Hershey vote no on the school name changes? Is it because she has filed to run for Jason Fisher's House seat and doesn't want to upset her base? And if that is the case, what a base. Fred Matthews board members Lori Hershey and Charlotte Joyce voted no on the name changes. And it's perceived among some that, at least in the case of Ms. Hershey, that she has higher political aspirations. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, that's the bottom line here. You look at who has skin in the game, who has things to risk. If they're looking at their political future, and of course they do it on the basis of it's going to cost too much to change the name, and why should we bear the cost of changing the names of this? In many cases, this is showing the progressive thinking in Jacksonville, which for many of us makes it a great place to live. But this is a long time coming, and it was not anything that you could continue to justify once this subject had been brought up again. We're not just talking about changing history. We're talking about correcting something that is offensive to a great deal of the student body, the public, that rolls by these schools and have to continually deal with it and explain it away. It is just difficult to explain to the 85-90% of African-American students at Lee why they would be running around with the name of a guy who basically would have fought to keep them enslaved for the rest of their days.
Yeah.
So, but for those two school board members, yes, they're doing the same thing that is happening on the state level. They're seeking to make sure that history doesn't make white folk look bad. And that's what they're saying here by discussions of the critical race theory and other subjects that have come up. Don't make us look bad. We don't want to talk about it. And, oh, we don't want this to make America look bad. So let's not talk about it, and let's stop these teachers from talking about it because it makes us look bad. And that's just not going to work in the long run, but we're in a conservative state government. And, yes, these two school board members are looking forward at what they want to be and want to do.
5492937. Here's a tweet from a listener. School names should never have been treated as participation trophies for Confederate treasonous losers. Charmaine is in Arlington. Hi, Charmaine. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
So on this topic, for me, and looking nationwide, you see a lot of historic landmarks or statues and monuments being taken down. But in my opinion, it seems as though we're allowing those to take away the accountability that they should have. So for me, having those students look at that every day, that's a strong point that makes them say, I'm going to go to an HBCU. I'm going to go and be a better black person since I'm walking through this school. But on another note, it could also be accountability measure for those who don't want to, acknowledge racism or things of that nature. Just like when those place up and knock down certain buildings and everything else throughout Jacksonville, you're taking down history, making it kind of null and void. People are going to forget about the true nature of Jacksonville, the true history, and then thus still yet you can still be forgotten as black people because no one's going to remember. All they see is the lavish sky rises. Mm. So removing the names, I think, is kind of irrelevant. I think that's a great thing to have the history remain and for others to acknowledge what they see as technology grows and education flourishes throughout technology even more. That will help the children see where they are and who they are.
Charmaine, thank you. Thanks for that. It's 5492937 as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. Right now, we're talking about the official decision to change the names of six local schools. It goes along with the efforts of groups like Take 'em Down Jacks and the Northside Coalition of Jacks and others who successfully pushed for the removal of Confederate statues and memorials in the city, although some of those have yet to officially be removed. Jimmy in Riverside. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that progressive in Jacksonville should never go in the same sentence. I've lived all over the United States, and the last thing I think of Jacksonville since I've been here is progressive. Getting to my point, taking down those names and statues, I think, is a waste of money. We could use that money to educate people. You could put a plaque up saying that this was a deplorable human being that thought it was okay to enslave other human beings. And that plaque would be less money than what we're about to spend on changing these names, and then, you know, no disrespect, but whitewashing history, because the Republican Party surely wants to whitewash history and have
Is taking down the names of people who rebelled against this country, were traitors and seditionists and enslavers, taking their names down is removing them, is no longer honoring their legacy. How is that whitewashing history? Isn't it more a better understanding of the true history of what happened in the Civil War?
Well, every word that you just used about those people should be placed on a plaque. Keep the name, because 100 years from now, no one will know. Keep the plaque so that we always know if we're condemned if we take away history and truth.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, Jimmy, because one thing they have done with this is they made a decision that the school names are no longer going to have the names of people because as history moves along, we often come to a different understanding of historical figures. Thanks for the call, Jimmy. You know, none of these schools are being named after people. They're being given much more generic names like Westside Middle School, Springfield School, Riverside High School and such. And the name changes go into effect August 3rd. You know, Ann Schindler, virtually all African-Americans in this city were behind the name change. Almost all African-Americans. The debate was between white people. White people who were on the side of the name changes and white people who were arguing to keep them. It was an argument mainly between different groups of white people.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting, you know, proposition that the caller makes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've talked about contextualizing, and very often people think that's not enough. But I mean, if you seriously think about slapping the words traitor, seditionist, loser in front of some of those names, mm-hmm. that would be a powerful historical phrasing, right, that would redefine how we think about those people. And that would probably have even been a larger battle. But the name change, you know, is not, these names are not necessarily historical to the schools. You know, a lot of these names were placed on these schools in recent history. It's not like they, you know, emerged right after the Civil War to honor the war dead. I mean, they came smack dab in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement as, you know, a middle finger to people who were seeking equality and justice. So I think the origin of the name matters as much as the name and what it symbolizes in history.
Doran on the West Side. Doran, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I wanted to just quickly point out for the callers who have emphasized the cost of changing the school names is really not that relevant. You had a guest just a few days ago. The leader of JPEF. JPEF is raising a significant amount of those funds privately. So as far as the cost, I don't think that's even a relevant issue. We should really be looking at what this means in terms of our society and in terms of what it reflects along the lines of the racial temperature, so to speak, of this this moment. And I appreciate the time. Mm-hmm. I'll let you continue with your show.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Doran. And thanks for all the comments about this. As we continue to talk about this story, let me give the phone number once again. It's 549-2937. So the final word on this, the name changes go into effect August 3rd. And if you do want to donate to the fund to pay for the name changes, go to jaxpef.org. That's the Jacksonville Public Education Fund. They are seeing quite a bit of donations, and they're a good way down the path to paying for this process, which will cost about $1 million. Now, speaking of schools, on Tuesday, the governor visited town to sign a controversial bill banning trans girls and women from girls and women's sports. This is in public schools. He signed the ban on the first day of Pride Month, but Governor DeSantis denies it had anything to do with discrimination. However, to rub salt in the wounds of those who oppose him, he made the announcement at Trinity Christian Academy in Jacksonville, which actually forbids homosexuality among its students. The school also has a long and sordid history, sadly, of enabling child sexual abuse. It's 549-2937 as we talk about this. Let's go to you, Ann. The governor shared the stage with a former high school track star from Connecticut who has spoken out against trans women in women's sports. She says she missed out on scholarship opportunities when she was outrun by two trans women. A peer-reviewed report on the National Library of Medicine's website does not support the claim that people assigned male at birth are universally stronger or faster than people assigned female at birth. The governor also says he doesn't care that business groups and sports associations like the NCAA might boycott Florida based on this new law. He also batted away criticism that it is further marginalizing an already marginalized and tiny group of students. We have to look at this, and I think, Ann, along with all of his other recent moves, through the lens of his aspirations to run, not only be reelected governor, but to run for president in 2024. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you're right. It is sort of not just, you know, this governor, but really all across the country, this year particularly, you know, a push by the GOP to solve problems that don't really exist. I mean, the concern about, you know, trans athletes and women's sport is, you know, infinitesimal, voter fraud, infinitesimal. But these are, you know, talking points that speak to the base of the Republican Party and whip up enthusiasm. You know, the governor in this case has denied, you know, that his move is discriminatory. And yet his actual quote was, you know, in Florida, girls are going to play girl sports and boys are going to play boys sports, which completely ignores the fact that, you know, a large segment, particularly of young people who are a little bit more fluid with their identity, you know, or comfortable saying so, you know, that people don't identify in this sort of binary, you know, one or the other way. And so even if you're not trans, you may not identify firmly as a girl or a boy. But, you know, the fact that he had to take his message to a private school to present when it only affects public schools, I think just speaks to, you know, the fact that this is not a policy issue as much as it is a political gambit.
Yeah. Let's mention that private schools like Trinity Christian don't have to even offer youth athletics, but they still do receive taxpayer money. And this law, Mike Mendenhall, it only affects public schools and public school kids. So, you know, you have to wonder, was no public school willing to host him for this event, or did he choose not to have it at a public school? We don't know the answers to that. And no one at the school board has weighed in on this, although it does affect public school kids in this city and in this state.
Yeah, it does. And as far as interpreting, you know, the governor's actions in signing the bill, I mean, like you said, we don't really know. But I mean, but the optics are very telling, you know, that he didn't sign this at a public school, and that, you know, this law, you know, specifically impacts public school sports. I mean, but there's no doubt, too, that, you know, this law will likely be challenged in court as well. Like, every law that tends to try to, you know, skew or suppress, you know, a civil rights issue, it will ultimately end up being challenged. And honestly, it'll elevate that issue. Probably put Governor DeSantis, you know, for better or for worse, and an even higher profile spotlight coming into the next two election cycles.
Yeah. Here's a tweet from Susan. People should show up and say they don't like these new rules. June 10th is the regular State Board of Education meeting happening in Jacksonville at FSCJ's Advanced Technology Center on West State Street. Fred Matthews, not only is this transgender sports ban going into effect, the Board of Ed is coming here in a few days to look at new regulations, new protocols for the teaching of history and civics in Florida that are also controversial. And we're heading into a summer break, But when we go back to school in August, that will be a new controversy that we'll likely be talking about.
Well, it's not to be unexpected. We are living in a conservative Republican environment in the state of Florida as far as the state government is concerned. And they're going to carry out every tenet that is on their wish list to be done. As I mentioned earlier, part of their discussions that are going around nationally is to this discussion about the critical race theory and its teaching, even though it's not being taught, even though teachers and education associations around the state and around the country are not teaching that. They're not doing it. The history books only talk about the battles of the Civil War. They don't necessarily talk about the backgrounds of the generals and the persons who were involved. But what this is for our State Education Commissioner Corcoran and others is an attempt to head off any discussion, again, about history, racial history, that will make them look bad. They don't want this to look bad, and they don't want their children to view history, American history, as anything but great. And manifest destiny is what we should always have been doing. And it is our right to take over everybody else's land on this continent because we wanted to. And they don't want anything, any part of history to affect negatively upon the United States. And that's what they're doing. And again, we get the government that we elect. And this is the government we elected. And they're going to do their darndest to make sure that nothing is being taught to students that will make America look bad.
If I could quickly, here's an email from a listener. There are differences between the sexes, and we aren't seeing transgender females now identifying as males competing in the male sports.
So saying we are not seeing that?
Right. One listener pointing out, why can't people who don't like this legislation acknowledge that there are biological differences that need to be taken into account? What's your response to that?
I mean, I'm not an expert on the biological differences. I mean, I feel like, you know, the question of whether this is or is not, material is just, it just isn't happening. You know, it's like, I also agree, you know, that when there's instances of, you know, voter fraud, it should be addressed, but it's not something that's occurring. It's not really a problem. And so, I mean, it's a tiny
group of kids. Let's begin with that, like a handful
of
children.
It's a tiny group of kids, but I mean, the flip side of it is that these kids are already like incredibly marginalized, bullied, sometimes, you know, attacked for being trans. I mean, they're probably the most vulnerable population in the United States when it comes to somebody outside of, you know, a racial minority, and they're targeted. So when you put them in the crosshairs of legislation that is, addressing something that has not actually been a problem in Florida, it can create problems for those kids. It can make them more vulnerable to attack and bullying. And it is it's a little bit of a punching down.
Right. And, it's been observed too that transgender people, non-binary people provoke these strong emotions because they upset traditional notions of patriarchy, frankly. They don't fit into patriarchal norms of gender. And I think that that's sort of what's going on at a deeper level culturally. But with all of that said, with just a few minutes left before we let this esteemed panel go, we want to go around the horn and notice some other quick headlines from the week. Yes, it's our lightning round. Did that just for you guys. I'll start. Make sure to tune in to the Florida Roundup today at noon when we interview Nikki Fried. The state's lone elected statewide Democrat has made it official this week. She will be challenging Ron DeSantis in the governor's race next year. Tune in statewide for that interview with Fried. That's coming up at noon. Mike Mendenhall, what else caught your eye this week?
Well, not only did Shad Khan come out with his latest thing on the shipyards, but there was also another $1.1 billion proposal to redevelop the riverfront in downtown Jacksonville. That deal's not as far along as what Shad Khan's proposing, but it just shows you that over $1.5 billion of development interest in downtown in 1 week. I mean, that's something significant and something to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. Fred Matthews, what's on your radar?
Well, I was delighted to see that the former spot where the landing was is getting so much play, where folks were able to go there and go to concerts and have a great time. And a developer is taking interest, of course. He wants to develop that space and make it more than that it is. And it will enhance, if he's able to get his way, it'll be another enhancement to getting a North Bank Riverwalk done. But quite frankly, it is just great to have it the way it is. It's a free space. You can go and have a good time downtown on the river and enjoy some good, great starry nights.
Thanks, Fred. Ann Schindler, what about you?
I've just been watching this unfolding yearbook controversy down in St. Johns County, where this week they've decided that they're going to offer reprints of the yearbook where the girls' photos were doctored to cover up their cleavage and shoulders. But some still are not happy. They would have to turn in their yearbook in order to get a new one, which might be letting go of probably the most well-known and possibly valuable yearbook in the United States.
Yeah, really. Thank you for that. And thank you all so much. Ann Schindler, Fred Matthews, and Mike Mendenhall with us on radio and our live video stream. Guys, thanks and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right. In a moment, Women's Wednesday is returning this month to St. Augustine after a year-long break. We'll tell you how you can be part of the fun and networking next.
Taxes, the environment, energy, education, healthcare, a state that's gaining nearly 1,000 new residents every day, and the ongoing quest for resources to meet that growing need. These are critical issues that affect everyone in Florida, and they're just some of the issues we follow every week on Capitol Report. It's your direct connection to what's going on in Tallahassee and what it means to you.
Tonight at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Biden has a new plan to get 70% of American adults vaccinated by Independence Day. It includes barbershops, babysitting, and free beer.
That's right. Get a shot and have a beer.
Plus, the voting rights battle heats up in Texas, and Biden freezes drilling in the Arctic. That's all ahead on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, after a year-long hiatus during the pandemic, Women's Wednesdays returns to the Treasury in St. Augustine this month, and two great speakers will be on tap to entertain the crowd. I got a preview from She Is Fierce founder Kelly Youngs. Take a listen. Hey, Kelly. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
It's exciting to talk to you about Women's Wednesdays starting back up again, of course, after a year or so of no in-person events. She Is Fierce is like a lot of other organizations. You're going to be bringing some people together. And this sounds like a great evening. Tell us what's on the agenda.
Oh my gosh, I am so excited to be hosting Women's Wednesday in person again this year. It is our ongoing annual series. This year we're just going to have one event. It's going to be a little bit smaller than we have done in the past, trying to be very careful and cautious. But also, I'm excited that it's going to be an opportunity for us to bring so many community leaders, community servants, and just really amazing, fierce women together in a room again and celebrate the ability to come together and also the people who've really gone above and beyond over the course of the last year.
Right. You'll have a tribute to medical personnel, first responders, and some amazing speakers, including Ellen Wiss, founder and president of Reed USA, and Lakeisha Burton with JSO.
Yes, these are two phenomenal women. Ellen has been a member of She Is Fierce for years now, and Lakeisha has spoken for us before, and so I asked the two of them to come together and speak on stage, which we don't usually have two speakers, but they're actually going to speak together, and very much to the mission of what it actually means to work in a nonprofit or to be a person who is actively being of service in your life. And so they're going to share a little bit of their inspiring stories individually, but they're also going to talk about service, what it means, how we can each kind of step into that in our own ways, because we all have different skills and talents and honestly time in the day and ways that we can get involved.
That's such a timely topic, because I think over the last year and a half or so, we've all had a lot of extra time to think about that, to think about our purpose and sort of reassess how we want to make an impact.
Yeah, I mean, even within She Is Fierce, we have been exploring on our podcast that we're recording for our new season, we've been exploring the idea of what it actually means to live on purpose. So instead of just trying to find meaning in what we're doing, to actually take action and be more meaningful in the everyday activities that we take on. And I think that Ellen and Lakeisha are perfect examples of people who do that in their day-to-day life. And I know so many of the women that are coming to this event, and I hope we will have some amazing women that I've never met before. But I know that it's an audience of people who are really trying their best to live with purpose and to find a sense of meaning. And so I'm excited to kind of come together as a community again and have the opportunity to celebrate that.
Now, you typically host these at the Treasury on the Plaza in St. Augustine. There's an old bank vault right there in this historic location. It's a really beautiful space. So if people haven't been before, this is your chance to kind of get back out into a group setting and enjoy a great group of women. Tell me a little bit more about the setting, because I'm trying to paint a picture for people who've never been there.
I'm grateful to you for saying that, because you're absolutely right. Not only is it a really fun event, and not only do we have these incredible speakers, but it's also just a gorgeous setting. So the Treasury on the Plaza is in downtown St. Augustine. It used to be a bank. As you said, their bar that they have set up is the old vault. It's a room just filled with these gorgeous columns and beautiful lighting. And, of course, we don't do our events like anybody else. We're going to have a DJ. We'll have uplighting and all kinds of fun stuff going on. And also the opportunity to participate and actually get involved and support Read USA and other organizations in really fun ways. So I'm excited to kind of bring everybody together in that beautiful space, have them have the chance to get signature cocktails and just enjoy an evening of kind of coming together.
And you have more planned beyond this event, too, coming out of the pandemic.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. So as you know, Melissa, and anyone who's in our community knows, I love the chance to bring people together in real life. We are obviously always doing online programming with She Is Fierce. But bringing women together in our hometown and our local community is really powerful. And in September, we have a She Is Fierce Success Summit planned. It is going to be the 22nd through the 24th. And just like our past years, we are going to have some phenomenal speakers, incredible breakout workshops, and honestly, a whole lot more fun. We've extended it from one day to three, and that gives us a lot more opportunity to just bring in really fun things as well.
Really great. Get your tickets in the meantime on Eventbrite for Women's Wednesdays coming up Wednesday, June 9th at the Treasury on the Plaza in St. Augustine, featuring Kelly, of course, but also Ellen Wiss, founder of Read USA, and Lakeisha Burton with JSO. She is running for sheriff, although that won't be part of this evening. So Kelly Youngs of She Is Fierce, the founder and CEO, always good to talk to you, and looks to be a great evening.
Thank you so much.
See you at the Treasury. Will be so much fun. And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Please join us again today at noon for the Florida Roundup. Our guest this Friday at noon, Nikki Fried, the state's agriculture commissioner, has made it official. She will take on Congressman Charlie Crist in the Democratic primary for governor, all about her campaign, plus other news and notes from the week across the state at noon. on the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. This show will be back at 9 a.m. Monday. So have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.